May it please the court, my name is Victoria Wolfe. Alongside me at counsel's table is Mr. Robert Palmer. Also involved in the drafting of the appeal brief was Mr. Andrew Sullivan, a Notre Dame law student who has since graduated. Thus, I have the honor of presenting oral argument to the court. And we represent Tyrone Holmes. This court granted a certificate of appealability to decide whether the district court erred in finding that two claims in Mr. Holmes' amended petition for habeas relief, his Brady claim and his contention that the state presented perjured testimony from a crime laboratory analysis, are procedurally defaulted. We request this court determine that Mr. Holmes' claims are not procedurally defaulted and grant Mr. Holmes' petition. Or in the alternative, we request this court remand the matter for district court for a full evidentiary hearing. The claims related to the blood evidence and false testimony are not procedurally defaulted. First, the Court of Appeals decided Mr. Holmes' claims on the merits, or at least they were intertwined with the merits. Second, when Mr. Holmes actually found out about Pamela Fish's laboratory notes is not necessarily dispositive. If Mr. Holmes found out about the notes after his third petition, there can be no procedural default. If he found out about the notes before his third petition and the court decided the claim on its merits,
counsel, the problem as I see it is that it looks like Holmes himself told the court that he found these documents, which he says revealed the problem, 14 months before he filed his third collateral attack in state court. Doesn't that completely resolve all of this?
Judge Easterbrook, I think the record says that his counsel was faxed the notes from the Assistant United States Attorney's Office on May 3rd of 2000, but the record is unclear when Mr. Holmes himself knew of these notes.
When I say himself, he or his authorized agent, and that includes lawyers. Notice to a lawyer is notice to a litigant.
And I respect that, Your Honor, except that Mr. Holmes, I respect the standard of the law that Mr. Holmes is charged with the knowledge of his attorney. However, this would be quite an injustice for Mr. Holmes to be procedurally defaulted based on his attorney's transgression. In particular, I know Mr. Holmes did not have a constitutional right to effective counsel at this point in litigation. However, he was raising those issues in that brief that you referred to. Furthermore, Mr. Holmes did give the Illinois Supreme Court an opportunity to hear this case, and that is all that is required. The Court of Appeals consolidated Mr. Holmes' second and third petition, and Mr. Holmes did nothing affirmatively to constitute a waiver or abandonment of his Brady claims or his false testimony claims. But really, Your Honors, at a minimum, the merits of Mr. Holmes' Brady and false testimony claims were intertwined with the Court of Appeals' decision. And this Court's precedent in Moore v. Bryant, where the Court noted there can be no independent and adequate state ground to prevent habeas relief when the last court made a decision that fairly appears to rest primarily on the resolution or interwoven, not clearly expressly relying on procedural default. The Court of Appeals said it is unclear whether Mr. Holmes knew of these notes before.
The Court of Appeals starts by saying that, and then it goes on, and it seems to me completely unequivocally says that, of course, Holmes himself said he knew, and we therefore find it default. Right? There are two stories that he did and he didn't. The state court says, and Holmes's story is that he did, and therefore he defaulted. Now, that sure sounds like an assertion of a procedural default to me.
And, Your Honor, I submit that Mr. Holmes always knew Ms. Fish's testimony was false. Whether he was privy to the laboratory notes, this court may determine, based on that knowledge, that Mr. Holmes would be procedurally defaulted. But even if you find procedural default, Mr. Holmes can have this case excused because he has established the cause and prejudice standards, the cause being the external impediment was before his trial he specifically requested these laboratory notes. They were not produced before his trial or after his first petition, and they may have only been produced for the first time sometime after his second petition. Mr. Holmes had the Cellmark tests before the filing of his third petition. If you recall, those tests showed that he had no blood on his clothing. However, the state's serologist testified that he did have blood on his clothing. And those notes, those laboratory notes, did give Mr. Holmes an independent Brady use. Mr. Holmes has also established prejudice, and that the failure to disclose those notes worked to his actual and substantial disadvantage. Mr. Holmes was denied the notes. Pamela Fish's testimony was false. In the closing argument, the state said, "We submit the blood found on Mr. Holmes was the victim's blood." They had no evidence saying that that was the...
This current argument seems to me beside the point. What your client needs is cause for failing to submit this contention as part of his third request, the one he made 14 months after the notes were called to his lawyer's attention. Right? Failing to submit it, it's not a problem of saying justifying his failure to submit it at trial or on direct appeal. He learned this only later. But so far as I can see, there's nothing that would count as cause for failing to submit it in his third collateral request, and that's when the state court found the procedural default. Now, you make this half-hearted argument that his lawyer furnished ineffective assistance, but of course, since he's not entitled to a lawyer, ineffective assistance is not a cognizable ground on collateral review. So is there any... If you put this ineffective assistance argument to one side, is there any cause for failing to make this argument on the third collateral petition in state court?
With the, which you've already addressed, with the exception of his attorney possibly not providing those to him, and I don't know if that would constitute excuse or the cause to allow Mr. Holmes to continue with the standard of why he did not raise that in his third petition. And as I mentioned, the second and third petition were consolidated. I do not think he ever actually gave up or abandoned his claims that the state presented perjured testimony, Your Honor. If I could continue on with the prejudice that was suffered by Mr. Holmes, even with the testimony that Mr. Holmes had blood on his clothing, which we indeed find that he did not, and with the prosecutor connecting the dots, Mr. Holmes did not have blood on him. And to say that Mr. Holmes did have blood on him, people do not generally have blood on them unless something sinister has occurred. And we submit that he...
I had blood all over me without anything sinister about it all. I got myself shaving a few times.
Thank you, Judge Bauer. We request this court. I see I'm cutting into my... rebuttal time.
I'd quit if I were you and go sit down.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Ms. Saunders.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Catherine Saunders for the respondent warden here. This court should affirm the district court's judgment denying habeas corpus relief because the district court correctly held that petitioner's claims were procedurally defaulted and that he could not excuse his defaults. The last state court to address petitioner's Brady and false testimony claims, which would be the state appellate court on his fourth post-conviction appeal, held the petitioner forfeited both of those claims because he could have brought them in his third post-conviction petition, but he did not. And that holding is an independent and adequate state law ground of decision blocking federal habeas review. Now, contrary to petitioner's contention, the state appellate court did not reach the merits of petitioner's claims outside the context of addressing whether he could show cause and prejudice or actual innocence to excuse that procedural default. And we know from this court's recent decision in Smith versus McKee that, like plain error review, a brief review of the merits in the context of a cause and prejudice analysis required to set aside a forfeiture in this way doesn't undo an otherwise enforceable state law default. petitioner can't demonstrate cause and prejudice or actual innocence to excuse his default. As Judge Easterbrook pointed out, petitioner received the serologist's notes in May of 2000, well before he filed his third post-conviction petition in 2001. He admitted in his fourth post-conviction petition that he did receive the notes on that date. The notes themselves bear printing on top, presumably made by a fax machine, as the notes were faxed to petitioner's counsel, and they also bear that May 3, 2000 date. And in the district court, petitioner's counsel twice stated in his reply, document 60, that in fact petitioner received the notes on that May 3, 2000 date. And having failed to demonstrate cause, this court need not consider the prejudice component, as that's a conjunctive test. The petitioner's brief, and this court asked the court the parties to address actual innocence. And petitioner's argument today before the court didn't really get into actual innocence, but I want to take this opportunity to point out that the evidence here against petitioner was substantial. His credibility was severely undermined by his ever-changing version of the events. Upon his arrest, he admitted to the police that he was with the victim about an hour before her body was found in the stairwell. But he lied when he said that he'd last seen her when he left her at the Powell's house to go to work. And when he was confronted with the fact that a witness, Jacqueline Wilson, had placed him at the scene around 5 o'clock, and confronted with the possibility of having his underwear tested for semen stains, he changed his story and said that he, in fact, had accompanied the victim to the apartment building because she wanted to buy drugs there. And hoping to explain the presence of any semen in his underwear, he said that he had been out drinking with an old girlfriend, Cora Flowers, the night before, and that he had had sex with her before going to the Powells. But that, too, was a lie, as we know, because Cora Flowers testified that she did not have sex with petitioner. And subsequent testing of the petitioner's semen, or the semen taken from the vaginal swab from the victim, revealed that petitioner couldn't be excluded as the source of the DNA. We have eyewitness testimony. We have petitioner's fingerprints. Against this kind of compelling evidence of guilt, the cell mark report and Fish's laboratory notes don't demonstrate innocence. Petitioner's actually waived his certified claims by failing to brief them in his opening brief, and therefore this court should summarily affirm. And even wavering procedural default aside, his claims are meritless. Even if the prosecution did suppress Fish's handwritten notes, the notes are not material. They say only that there are no stains identifiable as blood. But directly underneath, they do say several reddish-brown stains. So the notes are not necessarily inconsistent with the finding that upon viewing the pants that she saw some reddish-brown stains, couldn't determine whether they were in fact blood or not, but subsequent chemical testing confirmed that it was blood. As the state appellate court found, this blood evidence was little moment. Fish's testimony, her entire testimony, comprises 17 pages, 10 on direct. Only 3 pages of testimony go to this blood evidence. And the trial judge didn't place any emphasis on it. In light of this abundant evidence, there's just no probability that these notes would have changed the verdict. And his false testimony claim fails for the same reason as well. He can't established the state presented perjured testimony because the notes are not necessarily inconsistent with her trial testimony. So they failed to establish that her testimony was false, much less knowingly so. If this court doesn't have any questions, we'd ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
What importance should be laid to the fact that there was a cell mark concluded that Holmes was excluded as a source of DNA material from the non-sperm faction of
vagina. Sorry, I'm having difficulty hearing.
All right, let me call your attention to page 16 of the plaintiff's brief and the footnote.
Yes.
From the testing, the cell mark was able to conclude, we're in a footnote now, that he was excluded as a source of the DNA material, DNA obtained from the non-sperm faction. What is a non-sperm faction? Where did it come from?
The way I read that is that a vaginal swab would have DNA material both from the victim and the petitioner. And so he was excluded as the source of the DNA from that portion on the vaginal swab, that DNA that belonged to the victim. That is how I read that.
That's an interesting
But he can't be excluded from the sperm fraction. It would have there would be two donors on a vaginal swab in a case of a sexual assault, his and hers. And he could be excluded from the portion that was her DNA, but not from his.
It's a mysterious document, it seems to me, but there you go.
Ms. Wolf, anything further?
Yes, Your Honors. Only a couple of main points. First, starting off with the DNA, the Cellmark test referred to by Judge Bauer, we read that to mean that he was excluded from the semen portion of the vaginal swab and that he could not be excluded from the sperm portion of the vaginal swab, whereas he was a 1 in 2,900 chance of being part of the sperm, having DNA a part of the sperm.
No.
Also, the state discussed actual innocence, and we submit, and she also pointed out to the word count spent on the bite mark testimony, and I submit to this court that the bite mark testimony was hotly contested by four different experts, and the word count does not necessarily go to the weight the court put on it. The serologist who testified falsely at Mr. Holmes' trial was not contested. And furthermore, the attorney, Mr. Holmes' attorney's failure to provide notes where he has no ineffective assistance claim, Mr. Holmes has no other possible remedy for either the perjured testimony or the ineffectiveness of counsel. Therefore, Your Honors, we submit, if you please determine that his claims are not procedurally defaulted and grant his petition or at a minimum remand this back to the district court for a full evidentiary hearing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. And Ms. Wolf, Mr. Palmer, we appreciate your willingness and that of the Notre Dame Clinic to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement and the court will be in recess.